Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. We are on a very small numbered episode 48 today. I mean, we're barely starting out in the world. Ridiculous. 48, Claire.
I know, only 48. And we've only got about, 48 to go? 50?
At least. Who would have thought, though, that there would be so many interesting people to talk to about this particular topic?
Literally neither you or I, Zoe.
No, we really didn't. It's quite remarkable there are so many people working away in different areas about this.
And may I say the thing is as well that some of the people that we have spoken to, and particularly I'm thinking of our friend of the show, Judith Langland Scott, who mm-hmm. has spoken about Witches of Forfar, she's now gone away and done so much extra research. We need to get her back on soon.
Well, we definitely do. Yeah, she's fascinating. And she's going to be on the telly soon as well. So we need to make sure we do speak to her.
Exciting stuff.
So, Claire, how's your week been?
Oh, that was a new, you threw me.
Yeah, I'm doing a double bluff. Just go with it. Okay. How's your week been?
Yeah, it's been great. I've been working and I'm just sort of waiting for the next question.
In the course of your week, I just wondered if you'd come across any news about witches that you would like to share.
Can I say, ladies and gentlemen, while she was doing that, she was just sort of shrugging her shoulders.
Shrugging, casually, very casually. Cool. Yeah.
Are you asking me, Zoe, what's in the news?
The news, yes.
So you remember that we spoke to Heal and Harrow, Zoe. That was episode 19, only a few episodes back there. And they have put together the stories of women accused of witchcraft and also some of the stories of the allegations that were made.
Written by Mary Kidd.
Yeah, written by Mary Kidd into music and written word. And they have contacted us recently. Zoe, they've contacted us to say that they have remembered their promise in episode 19. We've been put on the guest list, Zoe.
Oh, how exciting.
I know.
I love a guestie. Love a guestie.
And their tour kicks off in 2022 on the 21st of January at Celtic Connections Festival in the Mitchell Theatre in Glasgow. And that's the one we've been invited to, Zoe.
How nice. That's good. I don't think I'm doing anything then, so that's great. My life is a sea of nothingness.
Don't make it seem like you had nothing else to do, Zoe.
No, I mean more like it's like a shining beacon of something to look forward to.
Good. Well, we want to tell you about the rest of the tour so that those listeners might be able to go and watch it. On the 9th of February, they're at Eden Court in Inverness, 11th February at the Tollbooth in Stirling, 12th February at the Sage Gateshead, 13th February at the Liverpool Philharmonic in Liverpool, 14th February at the National Centre for Early Music in York, 15th February at the North Wall in Oxford, 17th February at King's Palace, London, 18th February at the Howard Assembly Rooms in Leeds, and 19th February at Eastgate Theatre and Arts in Peebles. I mean, they're really going up and down the country.
Yeah, I'm really heartened to hear that it's not just in Scotland, that it's right down to the bottom of England too. That's very exciting.
Yeah.
That's great.
We'll keep you updated and let you know how that goes. The other in the news item that I wanted to bring up was that we were asked by the petitions committee that we put the petition into about getting a pardon, an apology and a national memorial. They asked us to write back by the 6th of December explaining what we thought was the correct process for seeking an application for a pardon. So you might remember that the committee had said that they were interested in looking into ways they might raise the issue by a pardon and were wondering whether or not the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission was the right way to go. And we explained that we didn't think that that was the right way to go and pointed out that in recent times, the way that the Scottish Parliament has dealt with these things is a legislative pardon. And they've pointed them in the direction of the pardon given to people who are involved in same-sex sexual acts who have been pardoned. And also, at the moment going through Parliament, there is a bill which is seeking to pardon minors for various offences where they would have been involved in protesting what was happening during the miner strikes. So we have given them that response. We look forward to a future date when they're going to consider it, and we'll keep you updated about that. So that's all my news, Zoe, but I'm just wondering, do you have any news?
Well, I've got some news, and it's quite interesting. We had a tweet directed at us, is that the right word to use? By another person who tweets on Twitter, obviously, who's very interesting. And I mean, it's one of these funny things about Twitter. You obviously don't know who anybody is, but we have a lot of interaction with another person who's really on it with lots of matters about history and so on. And they got in touch with us to say, well, they tagged us in to an article that had been in the BBC, on the BBC website, like less than a week ago, about the women. It's entitled "The Women Publicly Tortured After Being Accused of Sorcery." And it really just, it's a really interesting article, but it just really highlights the fact that this is a current issue. It's not a thing that is relegated to hundreds of years ago. This particular story, we've talked before about Leo Igwe on the continent of Africa. This story is about Papua New Guinea, where there is an issue, and it tells the story of a woman called Monica Paulus, who, when her father died, seemingly just, you know, of natural causes of a heart attack, her brother accused her of killing him using sorcery. She was threatened with being tortured to death. And she ended up having to flee and go and live in a different province of Papua New Guinea, which, as you'll know, is an island country away in the southwestern Pacific. Unfortunately, though, it says in the article that this is a unique position and that sorcery accusation-related violence is rife in Papua New Guinea. It says that although there's no reliable data available to know how frequently it happens, government figures say there have been about, and this is mind-blowing, 6,000 incidents in the past 20 years. And that's in Papua New Guinea, which is not obviously an enormous place. There is a suggestion that the figures are higher. It's usually women and girls that are accused of this. They're often subjected to brutal and sexualized violence. It's just really horrific. So they interview Stephanie McLennan from the Human Rights Watch, who says that we are talking about extreme levels of violence, some of the worst I've ever seen. They are very vicious mob attacks and victims are held captive, tortured, burned with iron rods, their clothes are stripped and they are often killed. So there's some really, really, honestly, mind-blowing for me is the right description, because you cannot believe that this still happens in this day and age. It's really terrible. So the original woman that's talked about, Monica Paulus, there's a suggestion there that the reason that her brother accused her was because her brother, once he made an accusation of sorcery against her, could then solely inherit their family home. So, and we know that that echoes cases that we've looked at in our campaign very historically, that some women were accused, and I guess some of the men too, were accused so that family members could inherit their land or their money or for some sort of financial reward. So it's just really crazy. And as Claire and I have mentioned various times in the past, the COVID-19 pandemic has really made things much worse, because there's kind of, for some people, it's inexplicable what's happened. I mean, we know with a science approach, you know, that is explicable, but there's a huge amount apparently of COVID denial and vaccine hesitancy in Papua New Guinea, which means that some people are accusing deaths related to COVID of actually being caused by sorcery. So it's a pretty scary story, really. And it just really shows the fact that it's so important that we recognize that this is a method of social control of people and that it's still relevant. So when people say to us, well, what's the point? It was hundreds of years ago. This is part of the point, which is that we need to stand with other nations that say, like, this is not acceptable. You can't accuse people of that to suit your own needs. So that article is on the BBC website and is obviously still available for you to read. It makes some really pretty scary reading, though. It's horrible. So that's my news, horrifying as it is.
Yeah, well said, Zoe. And I think that's all our news roundup. So once again, let's both shuffle papers.
Claire, do you have a list of people this week that were accused of witchcraft?
We do. And once again, one of our listeners have got in contact. This time it is Holly Gibb. And she has researched into her local area. She actually says that she just discovered the campaign on the 29th of October and has binge listened to the entire catalogue in 3 weeks, which is some good going, Zoe. What she said is that having listened to us, she would love if we could give a shout out to the local Pennycook woman in one of the podcasts. And I think for that degree of dedication of listening to all our podcasts within 3 weeks is the very, very least we could do. So Holly Gibb has set out for us the list of women in her local area in Pennycook that were accused of witchcraft. And obviously, as I remind people, if they want to go and research these further, they can go and look at the Witches Interactive map and or the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft, where they can see some of this information. But Holly has very kindly set out for us the story of some of the women in the Pennycook area, and I'm just going to read that out. So Isabel Dryborough, Margaret Small or Smeal, and Christian Townsend were all executed in September 1629 in Pennycook. Janet Pennycook, Janet Bishop, and Margaret Cuthbertson were all executed in December 1629 in Pennycook. So 1629 appeared to be a very relevant time for witchcraft accusations in Pennycook. She advises that there is an Anne Purcell in October 1629 mentioned in the records, but there is no information about her. And also Christian Simpson in January 1662. What she says about her is that she sounds as if she was hunted out, called demonic, and confessed. This was witnessed by 10 commissioners, one of whom was Mr. Thomas Henderson, advocate of Auchendinny. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, of the Few of Auchendinny, 1653 to 1664. Lastly, she ends on a high note. She explains to us that there was a good outcome for three women who were accused of witchcraft, the women being Christian Purdy, Agnes Elphinstone, and Marion Twiddy, who were accused in December 1661 by a neighbour, John Lowry. Now listen to this for a non sequitur, Zoe. He claimed that he saw the three women dancing round a fire, waving handkerchiefs, right? So, you know, dancing round a fire, waving handkerchiefs.
Morris dancing.
Morris, yes. Perhaps not in Pennycook, but he saw that happening, and lo and behold, a few days later, his horse died. Now,
what?
Exactly.
I mean, there's no logic. There's no logic to this. This is just...
It's something, and in fact, it's something that I spend quite a lot of time trying to talk to people about, is correlation does not equal causation.
I was trying very hard in the conversation yesterday to remember that phrase, and I couldn't remember it, and I tried to explain it, and all I could think of was that meme of the cat on the collapsed roof.
Yeah.
That you, I know that you've shared before the picture, and I need to remember that.
So, folks, what Zoe is referencing is a picture of a corrugated iron roof which is bent in. And it's obviously bent in through some force of nature or something falling on it. But right at the bit where it's bent in, a cat has decided to sit. And when you look at the picture, it looks as if the weight of the cat has forced the roof in and it's beveled to the weight of the cat. But the fact that that roof has beveled in and the fact that that cat was sitting there does not mean the cat caused that. So the correlation of the cat sitting there and the roof being bent doesn't mean it's caused it.
Similarly, if I saw three women dancing around a bonfire waving hankies and then my horse died a few days later, that's even less obvious link, isn't it?
It just shows you how there was literally no way you could try and get round these accusations because they were so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, even if my two friends were round and we decided to have a jig round a fire. Let's just even see that happen.
Yeah, yeah. I could see that happening. Not the hankies, but
Who in their time has not had a jig round a fire?
You haven't lived if you haven't.
Exactly. So you're having a jig round a fire. There's not much to do. There's not Netflix. people are maybe out dancing around a fire, and lo and behold, someone's horse died, and you're a witch.
Ridiculous. Completely ridiculous. Yeah.
But I'm delighted to see, as Holly has reported to us, that in this particular case, the woman took themselves to the commissioners that were interrogating them, and they demanded to be tried. They demanded to have their day in court, as it were. They were pricked, so they had to suffer the humiliation and embarrassment of being stripped and their body searched for devil's marks, and they were investigated and they were acquitted.
Wow.
They then had him arrested for slander.
Wow.
Yeah. He was in fact put to trial in Dalkeith in January 1662. And Holly says, I'd call that a win for the women of Pennycook. And indeed, I think...
Absolutely. So that's fantastic. Thanks so much for getting in touch. We love it when listeners get in touch and share stories about their own local areas. It's so fascinating.
We do. Thank you very much, Holly, for that. And it's really, really good of you for doing so. We really appreciate it. And shout out to those in Pennycook. If anyone has researched their own area like Holly and wants us in particular to do a focus on those, please, like Holly, do get in contact with us, because we'd love to read out the names of the women in the local area. So that's really, really great.
Excellent. Cool. Well, shall we lead on now to our guest for today, who is very interesting and is doing a really interesting project. So our guest today is Professor Nicola Ring, who works and teaches and researches out of Napier University. She's a qualified nurse and health visitor, and she worked in these areas, then moved into healthcare management and has worked at governance levels for local and national levels within the health service. She has done loads of really interesting stuff, and she's passionate about the social history of nursing and has expert knowledge of the topic. She strongly believes that understanding the profession's past, including issues of gender, power, race, and ethnicity, helps nurses better understand contemporary issues affecting healthcare practice and policy. So the reason that we're talking to her is because of a particular project that she has been involved with lately, which is Witches Stories, Persecuted for Helping Others, Documentary Analysis of Early Midwives and Nurses as Reported Within the Scottish Witchcraft Survey Database. So without any further ado, please welcome Professor Nicola Ring to the podcast. We are absolutely delighted to introduce today's guest, who is Professor Nicola Ring, who's going to be talking to us about one of her current projects, which I will let her explain in more detail. So without any further ado, Professor Nicola Ring, welcome to our podcast.
Well, thank you, Claire and Zoe. I'm really pleased to be here. It's actually quite surreal because I blame Claire entirely for this project because Claire actually was what kickstarted this whole process, because in lockdown, I remember reading about the Witches of Scotland campaign in one of the Sunday papers, and at the time thinking, oh, this is really exciting, because some of these folk healers and midwives that were accused of witchcraft, some of them were early nurses and midwives. So I read the article in the paper, I thought, that's very nice, I really should email this woman. Did nothing, obviously. And then a few weeks later, was out and about walking at lunchtime, and I heard Claire on the radio. And then I thought, something's going on here. The universe is telling me you need to contact this woman. So I emailed Claire, and she very kindly got back. And then we had a chat while she was walking her dog. And she was telling me where she was getting all her information from about these people accused of witchcraft. And as a nurse, I had no idea these records, because they were legal or church ones, I didn't know they existed. And so when I was talking to Claire, I suddenly thought, this is a project. I know what we need to do. I also knew who potentially could fund it. So I better give a shout out to my funder, the RCN Foundation, because we got an award for them. So after my chat with Claire, I very quickly found out, yes, the funders potentially could fund it, but I needed to apply, and the deadline was something like 2 weeks away. So with a bit of magic and a bit of fraught and a bit of pressure, we managed to get the application in and we were successful and we got the money and we did the project and we've now finished. The project is we worked from Julian Goodair's excellent, freely available survey of Scottish witchcraft database. And I'm sure that for most of the people listening to this podcast, they will know about this online resource. But to my shame, I didn't know about it. So what we did was we did a secondary analysis of just those accused witches who had a witchcraft accusation characterised as folk healing or midwifery. So it was just that specific group. And for people who've been on the survey of Scottish witchcraft on the SSW, they will know what we mean by a witchcraft accusation characterization. But, you know, for people new to the site, they can go on and they'll see what we mean and where we found these people. And so basically we just looked at 142 folk healers and midwives with witchcraft accusations relating to their curing and caring practices. So there are other folk healers and midwives on the SSW, but we didn't look at them because they didn't have witchcraft accusations characterised as that. And we also found other healers and midwives that were practising at the time who were not accused of witchcraft. So we're only looking at one group. So basically, we looked at them, we looked at who they were, why they were accused, what happened to them. And although that was really interesting to us to help to tell their stories, what we were really looking for was what they did in terms of their healing and midwifery practices. And I should say at this point who we are, because I should name check my two colleagues. So my colleagues on this project were Nessa McHugh, who is a midwifery lecturer at Edinburgh Napier with me as well. My other colleague who was involved in the project from the start is Rachel Davidson Welsh, and Rachel is a child health nursing tutor. So there was three of us from the beginning, and although we were all remote working when we submitted the application, I knew we all had an interest in the history of nursing and midwifery, gender issues, and also we really love just history generally. But also Rachel's first degree was in history, and she had studied aspects of witchcraft as part of that. And although I had forgotten, I had also studied social history for a year at university. And I did actually, when I was doing the project, realise some of the books that I was reading for this, I had actually read many moons ago as a student. So there was the three of us from the beginning, but towards the end or the middle, we had a law student, final year law student, who volunteered with us on the project. That was Bethany Reed. And then we were fortunate in the last few stages of the project that we could employ her for a few months as a research associate. So she joined the team initially as a volunteer, but then we were able to pay her. So that's the team, three of us from the beginning, and then a temporary help midway through.
So when is this information that you've got together, when is it being put together, and when will it be available for people to see?
What's happening is a very full report that we wrote that has gone to the funders, but currently it's embargoed. And that's simply because the research team are submitting manuscripts of our papers for journal publication. And so we hope to get the first paper off to a journal before Christmas and then one in the new year. But meantime, we are presenting the results at the Royal College of Nursing annual lecture on the 17th of November. And that's currently, it's free, but it's on Eventbrite if anybody would like to come. And so we'll talk more then about who we found, but also what they were doing. Because as I say, we were particularly looking at their curing and caring practices. So in terms of what we found, I think the first thing to say is that most people, when you say witch, have a stereotype in mind of an old, poor, uneducated woman who was healing was acting as a midwife, but that they had learnt from their mothers, and they did simple sort of folk charms and rituals. And most of the people, most of the 142 we looked at, did meet that stereotype. But we had a smaller but significant number that didn't meet that stereotype. And for us as nurses and midwives, the smaller number who didn't match the stereotype are for us hugely significant. So for example, three of the oldest people that we looked at were men. Having said that, because there's so little information about these people on the records, you know, only about a quarter had their age provided. But nonetheless, three of the oldest we looked at were men. We also found that some women learned their healing practices from men, sometimes their fathers or another male relative, but also that some women and men, you could say that their healing practices were actually kind of conventional healthcare practices for that time that could actually be considered best practice at the time. And some of what they were doing was what doctors were doing too. So for us, one of our key findings is that, yes, a lot of people did meet that stereotype, but actually in terms of the history of nursing and midwifery, the smaller number that we found, maybe 10 to 15, I mean, it's hard to tell because of the records, but we think that a smaller number, the ones that didn't match that stereotype for us are really important. And so we're in the process of applying for a little bit more money to try and do a bit more investigation on some of those people. So that was one of our findings.
Were there any key findings that surprised you, Nicola?
I think the fact that we had some women who learned from men and that their practices did suggest they were educated. But also, we know that the origins of hospital nursing lies within the religious houses, the monastic houses. And for us, the healers that were most significant were those accused of witchcraft in the early periods from the late 1590s into the early 1600s. So we think that potentially some of those who were accused perhaps less because what they were doing stood out, but the way in which they were doing it, which is that they were using words or charms that tended to reflect pre-Reformation religious beliefs or pagan beliefs. So there's loads more to be said about this, but not for today. It's like another discussion, and we need to do more digging yet. So that was a surprise. And I think also for us, the fact that quite a few of their practices and the way they practiced do resonate with nursing and midwifery practices today or more recently.
That's so interesting. Could you give us an example of a practice from then that resonates with today?
Well, because obviously I have this Eventbrite event coming up, I have to keep some surprises for then. But what I would say is that people wouldn't be surprised by knowing that obviously some of them were using herbalism. So some of the items like ginger or fennel, chamomile, these are still in use today. And I've been really fortunate that as part of the East Lothian Book Week programme, I did a podcast with Wendy Kelly, who's a herbalist. When she and I were speaking, it was so fascinating to hear the sort of rationale about why people might have been using particularly specific herbal products, for example. It's also the ways in which they worked. So, for example, quite a lot of times people were washing things. There's a lot of people washing shirts in South Running Water or Loch Water or something. And sometimes they were washing people. And, you know, in the history of nursing, if you're asked to think of nursing and you think of Florence Nightingale, all you can think of is that, you know, she advised nurses to wash everything. So things like that, that perhaps I think have been overlooked. I mean, yes, they may have been doing them for ritual reasons, but actually across the history of nursing and midwifery, washing people, washing things is hugely important. And even today, for all of us, if somebody's unwell, whether it's ourselves, if we've been really sick at home, or somebody in the family's sick, then one of the first things you'll want to do is to wash their hands and face as soon as you can. You want them in fresh pajamas, fresh bed sheets. And so while I think there's a perception that everything that these folk healers did, including the more ritual practices, had no meaning, that we would say as nurses and midwives, well, actually, they did have meaning and they still have meaning. So for us, I think that was a nice finding, I think. Okay, perhaps we're not going to a south running well water, but nonetheless, for us as practitioners, you know, we could still really see why cleaning patients or cleaning clothes was seen as really important. And, you know, maybe that sounds quite simple, but I think it has been overlooked by perhaps other people who've looked at these healers before, as, you know, they were just washing things in well water. But I think all of us have that belief still, that if you wash, you know, if you've been sick or somebody in your family's been sick, that if you wash their bed clothes or their pyjamas, that they will feel better. So for us, that connected what we do to what these people were doing. So maybe a small finding, but for us, it was nice to see that, I think.
Yeah, no, I can definitely imagine that, you know, that people might have been ascribing a different reason to why people got better if they were washed, or why people felt better because they were being washed. Of course, that we understand in the modern day that that might be assisting with hygiene and that might be assisting with keeping people's temperature down, but they were ascribing perhaps a different meaning to why it worked, but the same outcome, which is that people were feeling better by their interventions.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think often too, we found that when you read more recent documents about these trials, perhaps documents from the 1800s, then often the tone of the writing was quite dismissive. And I think perhaps by that point that nursing was seen as women's work, work that was done in the home. Also by that point, by the early 1800s, nursing did have a poor image, and organised hospital nursing had fallen by the wayside after the Reformation. So there is this perception that everything they were doing was dismissed and pointless. But actually, it seems that when you look at the language of some of these reports from the 1800s, that actually they downgraded what these people were doing.
So was it once again the men come in and take over a profession that women were doing?
Well, there's two things I would say there, Claire. So there are examples of where some of the men did later come in, doctors, and some of these folk practices were adopted by them. So, for example, the use of digitalis, the use of foxglove in healthcare and prescribing. But the other thing, and you mentioned earlier about surprising findings, well, we always knew that there were men who were healers and midwives that were accused of witchcraft. So we always knew that. But I think it's really important for us to recognise that, yes, there were gender issues around about that disproportionately most of those accused were women. But also, I think it's really important that we recognise the gender issues around about the men that were accused. And so there were 17% of those we looked at were men, and that's much higher than the number of men in nursing and midwifery. And when I say it's much higher in nursing and midwifery, I mean, in midwifery, I think the number of men in midwifery practice is very, very small. Sadly, Nessa's not here to tell me. So there were more men. I think it's really important that the gender issues around but the male healers are not forgotten about. And we also think there's some gender bias in the recording about what the men were doing. So when we looked at some of them in depth to look at what they were doing, we went beyond, for some people, we went beyond the survey of Scottish witchcraft. We went to look at original sources. And we feel that sometimes what was recorded and written about the men in terms of their healing, there's even less detail around about that. But talking about men though, we could only follow up people where there were records that existed. So for example, there was a man called Thomas Eagle in 1597 in Aberdeen. And there's nothing on him and his wife who was also accused, because they were declared fugitives. But we would have loved to have been able to investigate more of him, because he was described as a folk healer and a midwife. And one of the things he was doing was he was charming both women and animals during labour. So he was working as a midwife. And so sometimes, although there's no information about people like Thomas Eagle, you still feel that from a professional perspective that we want to name them and say, look, you know, here was a man that was supporting women and cattle during childbirth and was regarded as a midwife, but there's no more information to be had on him.
Is that, I mean, I don't know if this is just pure guesswork, but is that because it was seen as not being an appropriate profession for a man?
Not at that time, because remember, medicine wasn't a profession at that point, so the name medicine wasn't protected. And also, remember, the first professor of midwifery was a man. But mm-hmm. I don't know as much about the history of medicine. That's not my area of expertise. But I don't think at that time it was an issue, because I think one of the things we noticed was that some of the healers did work on animals and humans. So I think there was a much more fluidity around about roles and who did what. And that would make sense, because in very small communities, and he lived in a hamlet, then you would need people that could help deliver like sheep and deliver babies. So no, I don't think there would have been anything around about how that work was perceived. I think it's more the fact that there's no records for him was because he and his wife obviously left the area as soon as they could.
Fugitives because they'd been accused of being witches and they'd taken to the road.
Yeah, you know how often people who were accused of witchcraft, often they had a long reputation for that and had often been accused before. So, you know, there were quite a few people that we looked at that had been fugitives. Sometimes they were then caught and then still tried and then were maybe executed. But yeah, Thomas Eagle listed folk healer and midwife. But sadly, we could find no more about him. And it's a shame because we would love to have. Another thing that surprised us was that it's really important to not be gender blind about the men that we were looking at. I think there were gender issues going on in more than just the obvious women being accused by men, for example, or being tried by men.
Was there anything that you found personally when you were doing your research?
There was probably two things that struck the three of us. The fact that so many of these people, particularly women, were accused or they had witchcraft accusations characterised as neighbourly disputes. So it sounded as if when you read the stories that sometimes these were assertive women and maybe standing up for themselves or for their families. And so, you know, in the 2020s and before, you know, women are encouraged to be assertive. And so for us, that made you feel even more that actually this could have been our fate, myself, Nessa and Rachel's, you know, three women that were healers or midwives and were quite assertive and also didn't conform necessarily to the social norm. So that was one. And then the other issue too is that the more I was looking at the online survey for lots of different things, it's very easy to go down rabbit holes when you're on that site, to pull up all kinds of things. And so these were not people that we looked at within our study, but I suspect that two, maybe three of the women accused, I think probably are my family ancestors. So that was a surprise for me. I mean, I don't think I'll ever know because it was so far back, but I suspect based on location and surname, especially for one that had an unusual surname, I think that, yeah, these are some of my ancestors.
That's amazing. The map is so good. Using the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft and also using the interactive map can allow people to search for areas and search for names. Is that how you did it?
That sounds very systematic. So I should actually say yes, Claire. That was how I was doing it as a researcher. But no, it was completely chance. There's also a list of names. These are old names and then the modern equivalent. So one of the times I noticed the unusual name in the modern equivalent. So I think if somebody has got a long tradition of their family or part of their family living in Scotland, then I think they should look on the online survey. And I think It also helps if you've got a knowledge of your family history. Like my family lived there, say, in the 1700s. So you do need a bit of a knowledge about your family history. So that was a bit of a surprise. There are some surnames that people have today, and I'm not going to name any of them, but there are some surnames that do name which. And, you know, I'm thinking that, again, it makes you think that actually the impact, I think, on these families of those who were accused, that's a story that we will never understand and never know about. And I think because as nurses, and I was a health visitor, so, you know, I understand a lot about families living in the community, but I think for me, that's probably the sadness about this is there's a sadness clearly about what happened to these people that were executed, but for their families, because often the families had to pay for the execution costs or the prison costs for these those that were accused. But some of these involved had young families, or they had younger adult children that were accused who would have had families. So what happened to these people? What happened to them? And, you know, when you think that there are some, there's at least one surname that does mean witch, and you're thinking, you know, that name must have been given to somebody, to the surviving relatives or a woman that was banished or whatever. And so I think, I know it happened a long time ago, but the more you delve into this, you don't feel disconnected from those people. And it must have been, the impact on the families left behind must have been absolutely horrific. Not just the finances, but loss of a parent or parents. If they'd had to forfeit assets, it could have meant that they all ended up in poverty. So that's a sadness, really.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you really become involved in this research at all, that's really what becomes apparent so quickly, that you just look at these people's lives and imagine yourself in those circumstances and think, how did these people cope with what happened to them and what was the effect on their ancestors? And we spoke before to Leanne about historical trauma that goes through this, and she suggested, Leanne Maitland suggested in an earlier podcast, that there is intergenerational, transgenerational trauma that might still reverberate in the country today. People who perhaps would have been now rich and wealthy landowners who were dispossessed of it at that time and now, you know nothing of that part of their history. But it's so interesting that you yourself have made that possible real connection with people that were involved, and it might spur on our listeners to perhaps try and do that themselves.
Yeah. Obviously, I know that the emphasis for this project came from your legal campaign, and I know that the records are incomplete, but nonetheless, it's clear that there were many different types of miscarriages of justice, not just things like, you know, the forced confessions, but also people who were frightened that others were after their assets. Mm-hmm. There was also, I think, Janet Cock from Dalkeith, and she was acquitted at first trial. And somebody wanted her guilty because they tried her again and made one change, I think, and that swung the outcome against her. So, you know, often you knew that it was going to be quite distressing because you knew that there was torture and at least sleep deprivation and witch picking, etc., all going on. But sometimes when you read these smaller, not smaller cases, but like Janet's example, you think, gosh, actually, there must be so many more examples like that that are just not recorded. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting to read as well. And I should say that we did follow some people up in depth, because either what they did as healers or midwives stood out, or their stories stood out. So one of them that we investigated was Alison Balfour. And for myself and Rachel, as two child health nurses, the role of her young children in the forcing of her confession made us feel that we had to try and find out more about what she was doing as a healer. We didn't find very much, but we felt compelled to find out as much as we could about that woman. Because at the moment, mainly what exists is about what happened to her and to her family. And we wanted to try and see if we could at least find out a little bit more about what she was doing as a healer and midwife, because we felt we owed it really to her and her children. So we could be criticized for why we decided to try and find out more about her, but we just felt compelled. For us, it really does fill little gaps in our professional histories. You know, to be able to give the names of midwives that were working in the late 1500s and a little bit of insight into what they do, I mean, that's just phenomenal, because we thought that we would never, ever know anything about these people. And so from that point of view, you know, usually history is about the history of white privileged men that were educated, and it's really, it's been lovely to be actually to say, look, these were regular people in their communities that had a key role in helping others. So it's really lovely to be able to name them. And I think it's nice to name them in a way that's positive. So rather than them just being known for their witchcraft accusation, I think it's really nice to say, actually, they're known because of what they were doing, and particularly those that were practicing in a way that, you know, resonates with today.
Well, Professor Ring, we are truly grateful for the time that you've given up to speak to us today, and we thank you so much.
Right. Well, thank you too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. It's been absolutely fascinating. Again, as usual, please get in touch with us on our socials. I can't believe I'm saying socials. Like, what do I think I am? Like an influencer or a teenager? It's ridiculous. Please get in touch with us on social media. So you can get in touch with us on Facebook. That's just a page, but also people message us. Claire, have you done more TikToks?
I have not done more TikToks.
I mean, come on. So we do have, what, one TikTok. We've got a YouTube channel, which has got content on it. That's things that, you know, like our symposium. I think there's stuff from there on there and various other things. And also on Twitter, which is my preferred method of delivery of social media, because we can actually just chat to people. And that's been a really great way to meet tons and tons of people.
May I give a shout out for Instagram?
Oh, yes, Instagram. Yeah.
We've actually got a really, really big number of followers on Instagram. People.
Yeah.
People like the visuals as well. And actually, I have quite a lot of interactions with people there as well. But I'm wondering, we're talking about all these socials and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it time, Zoe, for you to drop the C word?
Oh, yes, I suppose so, because it's like clearly December now, and it must be like something like the 12th or the 11th or something like that today. I'm not really sure what day is. It's yes, okay. It can be Christmas now. I don't feel very Christmassy though. I'm going to go and get my booster jab today. So maybe I should wear a Christmas jumper while doing that.
Wear a Christmas jumper and a set of reindeer ears.
No, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that.
Might I say though, to spread Christmas cheer, might we ask that you consider buying our sound engineer, David, a festive cup of coffee?
Oh, that's nice, because then he can buy himself some reindeer ears if he so desires. I presume he's not really into stuff like that. So yes, that would be great. Please do, because he does such a sterling job of taking our, shall we say, raw output and turning it into a silk purse.
Yeah, I mean,
a satin purse.
We're like a very kind of scat jazz version of that. And David takes all those disparate bits of chat and he tries to draw them into some kind of musical sound.
Poor David. That's a wee shame. So if you feel like buying him a coffee, I think he earns it, I would say. And also the same with our merch. If you are looking to buy Christmas presents, you could think about that maybe, because all the money from that goes to David. We are totally not a for-profit organization in any way whatsoever. We're not a charity. We're less even than that. There's just the two of us doing this for free, and David very much working for free. So if you do feel like supporting David through those things, that'd be amazeballs.
It would indeed. Thank you very much for that.
Yes. Okay.
Amazeballs.
Okay, right. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, and we look forward to you listening to us again next episode. Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.